Today's topic is going to be on how to raise cattle without hay. So, and it's like in some place like Montana or whatever, where most people, the traditional technique for raising cattle is that you put up a lot of hay during your warm season, make hay while the sun shines, and then over the winter you feed the hay back to the animals. And I have to admit, I have done a lot of that. So when I was a kid, for many years growing up, I lived with my granddad. We lived on a little cattle ranch. We had about 500 head. I think at some point in time we had 1,500 head, but most years we had 500. And my job was to get on the three wheeler and go out there in the morning, 5 a.m. And I remember there were some days when it was like 30 below. And then as I'm riding out there as an 11 year old on the three wheeler, the water on my eyes would freeze up. And I remember as we worked, then we would sweat and develop a little icicle. I remember getting a little icicle on the end of my nose, but it'd be this like little layer of water between the icicle and my nose, because my nose was just that warm. And my brother and I would kind of have a contest to see who can develop the bigger icicle before it would fall off. As we're like, breaking off leaves of hay and throwing it down to the feeders and moving to the next feeder and putting on more hay, and then the next feeder, and then you got to get all this done in time to be able to get back home, get breakfast, and get on the school bus. So that's a slice of my history. And then later when I had my farm on Mount Spokane, I had cattle in too and hay. But the idea of raising these animals without hay. So I'm here today with Owen Hablitzel. Did I pronounce your last name correctly?
You did.
Weird. See, looking at your last name, how it's spelled, it looks like a challenge. But okay, I'm getting it. I'm getting better at this. Owen Hablitzel. All right. So, and Owen, your street cred is?
Some of my background is in I'm a certified educator with Holistic Management International, which of course deals a lot with livestock producers, and not exclusively, of course, but we have a lot of techniques and planning strategies that have been developed around that model. And I also work with the permaculture frameworks and key line design frameworks and resilient science to a degree. So I bring a few different, I suppose, sustainable agriculture approaches together wherever I can, and always looking to learn new things as well.
So then the holistic management stuff, I always attach these things to people. So I know, so that's part of Alan Savory's outfit, and he wrote the book Holistic Management. And isn't that book like 30 years old or something like that?
Something like that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
He's been developing that whole process since probably the 50s, really, but the book, of course, didn't come out until more recently than that. But
right, and so this is a huge industry is now built up around this, and doing it this way. I mean, most of the cattle people that I know do it this way. I suppose the CAFO people don't, but all the people. Anytime I see cattle out on land, it's being done that way, and the reason it's done that way is that the ranchers have learned you make a lot more money doing it this way than doing it where you just have them all on one patch of ground. And so it's like anymore, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody that raises cattle and then they don't do it this way or raise cattle, in any quantity. I can imagine somebody who has like two steers might just have them on open pasture because they don't really know. But and you're nodding your head, so this is the part where you validate what I just said.
I think there are a lot of producers doing it this way. Alan Savory, I've seen him make the claim that there are 40 million hectares worldwide on four continents practicing holistic management, being managed in a holistic fashion. But that being said, it's still not the conventional paradigm of what's happening out there at all. So I'd have to disagree on that point to a degree, because if it were the conventional paradigm, we wouldn't need to be here having this conversation.
Well, I mean, the conventional paradigm is usually that, I mean, because the oil is subsidized and corn is subsidized, you end up with this corn that has been double subsidized, and it's so cheap, and even though cattle are not designed to eat corn, that's what they're fed, because they will actually not die from it, and it's so cheap, and so they stand around in their own shed all day and with no grass, and they're just fed corn, and because they get sick from it, then they're medicated heavily, and so that's, I mean, but when you see cattle on pasture, I mean, it's something like holistic management. If it's not holistic management, it's something like it. And I usually refer to it as paddock shift. And I think that's going to lead into our first question about, you know, we've got to get our vocabulary down.
Yeah.
But now am I getting at least closer?
Well, there, I think, to my understanding, that, you know, probably more producers than not are still using something called continuous stocking, where the animals, even if they're on pasture or on range, they're being put out there more or less most or all of the year, or for, you know, large portions of the year, and the area is not divided up, and they're not necessarily rotated. Now, there are a lot of producers that have moved into more of a rotational grazing system, where the total area that they have for forage and feed is broken up into smaller units, and the animals are put out onto those units for, you know, varying amounts of time and at varying densities, depending on who you are, how many animals you have, how much land, and those variables. But none of those things would I call being really even like holistic planned grazing, which is the specific sort of process that we use in holistic management in my education and consulting work is more of a way of, yes, rotations happen in that planned, holistic planned grazing, but they don't happen according to any fixed set schedule, which is kind of the normal scenario for rotational grazing. Is sort of, it's more or less a fixed schedule, and it's like, well, they're going to be a month over there, and then next month over there, and not necessarily as much attention is paid to what's happening with the plants and the system, and especially with their recovery times of the plants, you know, the amount of time before you bring the animals back to that area or paddock or what have you.
So now, all right, so now I'm getting a little hung up in this space,
okay,
because you said a couple of things that are new to me.
Good.
And so then I want to explore those a little bit. And I know that there's going to be differences between holistic management and simple paddock shift. I think you're going to start with paddock shift, and you might evolve into holistic management.
Right.
Okay. But you also said something about continuous something or another. And so then I'm thinking, whatever that continuous thing was, it's like, oh, here, I've got 200 acres, and I just turn all the animals loose on the 200 acres. Good luck, animals. You're on your own. And then someday I'm going to come and harvest you.
Yeah, I mean, that's an awful lot of producers do and have done that, and it's called continuous grazing. You know, it doesn't take as much labor, and there's an efficiency aspect there, or management time or skills. You turn the animals out. Maybe you've got a huge, you know, range area, and at the end of the year, or come when you want to sell them, you come and count them, you know, see how many you lost in the meantime, if any, and you go from there, kind of thing. But
and you're thinking that's the dominant form of cattle management right now?
It's probably pretty close to the dominant form, more or less,
okay,
and especially traditionally speaking in the last, you know, century and so.
So now I've heard of, like, gobs. I mean, it seems like nearly everybody that I've run into that has more than five beef animals that they're doing some form of paddock shift. Now, granted, everybody's got, I mean, there's so many different recipes. And then the only time I've ever seen the continuous technique is, like, if somebody's got two that they're raising for themselves or for themselves and a friend, and they've just never heard of paddock shift. So I'm stunned. I didn't know that there are people doing the continuous thing, because it's like, it just seems so smart. And so when it comes to paddock shift, I mean, the recipes vary from, I mean, I don't think anybody leaves any animals on the same piece of ground for longer than 10 days. I think 10 days is the extreme outside. And while the people that are like really into it tend to do it either once a day or twice a day, my uncle said that he actually got better results from moving them every 20 minutes, although I would think that you would do it every 20 minutes for a while, and then let them rest, and then every 20 minutes for a while. I don't know. But he said he got even better results on the same land by doing it that way. But I mean, most of the time, it seems like when you're talking about homesteaders who might have a herd of five, then it's like, yeah, you put them in there and they're there for a week. And then you move them to the next paddock, and then that first paddock gets at least 30 days of rest before the animals come back, before those animals come back. You might let other animals in, but, you know, like the cattle will be there, will be gone for at least 30 days. That's kind of like the norm. That's the one I hear of the most often.
Yes.
So, okay. So how about this? Let me just verify for you, with you.
Yeah.
I'll say a thing, and then you can tell me whether I'm stupid or, like, it's pretty spot on. And the thing I've been telling people for years now is that when you do a paddock shift system, typically you will witness five times more growies, five times more lush, five times more growth of stuff, typically with your grasses and forbs, but you'll actually see with other plants as well, just not as much as with your grasses and forbs. Your grasses and forbs will be dominantly the ones that really thrive on a paddock shift system. But, you know, the thing I think a lot of people might have a hard time believing is you'll see five times more. So am I exaggerating?
Well, I mean, it depends.
Ah, yes. The permaculture answer to everything. It depends. Okay, yes, I agree. It does depend.
Yeah.
This has been my experience, and it seems to me like with many, many of the people that are practicing this, it's also been their experience. But now, yes, I imagine that if you're grazing on cement and then you use the paddock shift systems, it's like, wow, there's been nothing new growing on this cement.
Yeah.
And then there's this whole spectrum between cement and soil, and so yeah, your mileage may vary.
Mileage may vary, and of course, one of the things it depends on is the environment you live in. But what maybe most importantly, what it depends on is not so much it's more the recovery time of that you give those plants, and especially the plants that you're trying to let come to the foreground, that you want more of the desirable species. Let's say when you focus sort of the timing of recovery around what's best for those species, you're going to see a response. Now, I probably wouldn't go around and just as a blanket statement say you're going to get five times more forage in there.
Turns out you and I are different.
We're different. My mentor, I sort of come from the tradition of under promise, over deliver sort of thing. So then, you know, if you're pleasantly surprised by what happens, then even better, because it's a great incentive.
So what's your marketing pitch? You've got 10 seconds. Pitch it.
For my marketing pitch for what?
I don't know. So you meet some kind of, you meet a guy who says, yeah, I got me 2,000 head. And then you're like, hey, are you doing this holistic management stuff? And he's like, sounds like hippie talk to me. And then the elevator, so this is the elevator pitch. So the elevator is going to reach its destination in 10 seconds. And so what's your pitch? I mean, I say five times more growth. You say...
I would just say, well, if you want to, you know, improve your quality of life, your financial bottom line in particular, folks are interested in that, and sort of increase the amount of animals and the health of the land you're working with some planning procedures, then let's go to it.
So I guess if I say five times more, I suppose my five times more growth could be cut your feed costs by a factor of five. I could say that. I mean, then I've included money, but you're not going to say by factor of five. You're just going to say, currently you're making $1 million a year. I might be able to add $20 to that pile.
Well, here's the thing. When we're talking about hay, which is part of the reason we started the conversation, you can eliminate those costs basically entirely over time.
Yeah.
That's
the purpose of our talk.
That's the largest cost, you know, for most cow-calf producers, for most people raising cattle. That's the single largest cost is winter feed hay. So if you can eliminate that cost, that affects your profitability. Because what is profitability but, you know, your expenses minus your income, or, you know, your income minus your expenses, rather.
Right.
So if you can eliminate most of your expenses or a huge portion of what is your largest expense, you're going to be much more profitable. And the second half of that, if you increase your forage supply, which we have seen increases in places of 400%. So it's not quite five times, but it's a lot. But let's say you even double your forage capacity. That, of course, means you can run more animals on the same amount of land, so therefore increase your income. So if you simultaneously decreased your largest cost of doing business and increased your income stream by a significant amount, well, clearly that will affect your profit in a positive way.
All right. So I think we've kind of started to touch into this a bit. But now I want to, before we get into the thing about how we're not going to have any hay, how we can get by without having any hay, which I think is a very important topic to cover, I want to touch into a little bit about vocabulary. And so you're going to be an expert in this, and I'm a plebe. And so there's a few different terms that are bandied about, and I want to try and find out if they're all the same or how they differ, in your opinion and your experience. So the terms are holistic management, mob grazing, paddock shift, and rotational grazing. So there's four phrases, and are they all the same, or do they each mean something different, or are a couple of them the same? How do we sort through these so we can clarify and nail down our vocabulary so we're able to talk about this stuff?
Absolutely. Well, they're all definitely related. They're all basically working with cattle systems. That for holistic management can apply to other things too, being a holistic type of system. It's really a decision-making framework and with many planning procedures, but one of them is very specifically grazing planning, holistic planned grazing. So holistic planned grazing, you might use mob grazing depending on if that fits your goals and, you know, in your land and the animals you have. And you will be doing paddock shifting or rotational grazing or a form of it, but a very specific planned form of it that you're optimizing your forage base as well as your animal condition as well as your bottom line and, you know, your quality of life ultimately. That's kind of what makes it holistic there. Now, mob grazing, doing mob grazing, you're also normally going to be doing paddock shifts or rotational grazing. I think of paddock shifting and rotational grazing as more or less a synonymous scenario, or at least close. So in any case, if you're doing mob grazing, what that usually implies is you've got a high stock density. So the actual number of animals on a given area is very high. You might be running, there are producers doing, you know, 500,000 pounds of beef to the acre, or, you know, even more. It doesn't have to be that high to be probably called mob grazing, and I don't know that there's a specific weight per area cutoff to call it mob grazing, but generally it's a much higher stock densities than are traditionally run. Certainly in continuous grazing, the stock density is very, very low. which is why you end up with the problems of many plants are overgrazed and many other plants are overrested. They're not grazed at all because at those densities, animals are much more selective and they just tend to eat the chocolates, if you will, their preferred plants. Whereas when you get into these higher densities, not necessarily even to the level of mob grazing, but you get into the higher stock densities, they're less selective about the plants that they're eating. So you tend to get less plants that are overrested as well as less plants that are overgrazed, assuming you're paying attention to those things. So by the time you get to mob grazing, though, that's where the scenario sounds like your uncle was probably doing something like that. If you're moving the animals every 20 minutes, it's probably because you have a very, very high stock density.
Right, and when we're talking about stock density, we're talking about, and it's not necessarily the number of animals as much as it is the number of animals per acre kind of a thing.
That's right, per unit area.
And you're kind of trying to more emulate, like, you know, because it used to be like you'd have a herd of like 10,000 animals or even 500,000 bison in a great big gob. And then, like, you know, the ones at the front would hit into a new piece of territory, and the ones at the back might follow up a day and a half later. But they're all, like, you know, like there might be, if you got a picture from space of them, the space between the animals might be about the same as the space of that's taken up by the animals. Like, that's dense. That's, like, you know,
very dense.
Yeah, and so then and they had a reason for that, and it was to protect themselves from the predators. And so it's like, let's emulate that. And there's different ways to emulate that, but it's like you might be able to try and do something like that with I don't know, only 40 head of cattle, and it's like, but then you just got to keep them packed tight. Although I think that when you're doing that with only 40 head, then the electric fence would be close enough that I think that your psychological barrier would be freaking out the animals a little too much. So I think that that's probably a bad idea to try and do 40 as mob grazing with an electric fence. That would be just wrong.
Well, yeah, most folks doing that I've heard of doing any kind of mob grazing have quite a few more animals working than 40 of them. But you can still do high stock densities with 40 animals, and it can work out just fine.
Right. So usually they'll do 500, and they'll use electric. But then when you got 500 in electric, then the animals have a place where they can go stand and not be freaking out about the fence. Because the fence is over there. It's like not a big deal. But when you're trying to 40 and you're trying to pack them real tight, it's like the fence is like really close, and it's like, don't bump me. I could bump into the fucking fence, and I don't want to ever do that again. I hate the fence.
Yeah, they don't like the fence, which is a good thing for management.
yeah. So stress, man. All right, we got the phrase. Mob grazing implies high density.
High stock density, that's right. So,
okay.
And, of course, your stock density is different than your stocking rate. The rate is just, say, the number of animals that you've got out over your entire amount of land for maybe the year. But the density is, you know, like you said, how many animals on how much area for a given amount of time.
So, and holistic management is going to cover all of these other three phrases can fit under holistic management, and of course there's a bunch of other stuff that fits under the holistic management umbrella.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
So then the last two are paddock shift and rotational grazing.
So, I mean, those are basically, you know, both just the idea of you're moving your animals from one area to the other. If you have fenced paddocks, it can just be shifting them from one to the next. And if you're calling it rotational, maybe you've got fenced paddocks, maybe you have maybe you're out on range and you're moving animals just with herding, you know, but you're shifting them around the given land area that you have. So it's not a continuous grazing, it's a rotational grazing. So you're rotating around the given area, whatever strategy you're using to do that rotation.
So I'm not sure, but I think what you just said was that the difference between paddock shift and rotational grazing is that paddock shift definitely has a fence, whereas rotational grazing could be things that might have a fence or might not have a fence.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard people use paddock shift just basically synonymously with rotational grazing. So there may or may not be that difference depending on who you're talking to.
Some people might be that anal, and some people might not be so anal.
That's right. The overall idea, though, is it's not a continuous grazing, but you're moving animals from one area to the next over, you know, your whole grazing season. And maybe you're coming back to an area, but you're basically rotating around the total area over the season. But it doesn't necessarily involve specific planning. It's just the fact that you're rotating them, whether you're planning specifically for that or not.
All right. So we've nailed down some important vocabulary. Now to move into the big topic, the idea of being able to raise cattle and you don't keep any hay. And so now I've read of people doing this, and I've only read a few reports, not a lot, but now you've probably heard of a lot more people that have done this. Maybe you've even participated in it.
Well, there are a lot of people doing this, and more all the time are moving that general direction. Of course, it's not a leap that you take. You decide in January, well, you know what, next year I'm not going to feed any hay, and you know, you've gone from 130 days of feeding hay to zero. It doesn't happen overnight, of course. It takes...
Good luck, cows! Good luck! You're on your own. Let me know how it works out. I hope you don't die.
That's right. Yeah, that probably wouldn't work out well for anybody in that scenario. But so, yes, it takes planning, it takes strategy, and it takes, you know, understanding, you know, the resources you have and how sort of reconfiguring how you're working with them, and even your business structure to a degree can be involved in a restructuring there to make it possible.
Well, I think the benefits are obvious, but just for hoots, go ahead and can you spell them out?
Well, sure. Well, I mentioned 130 days of feeding hay specifically because, I mean, it's not just a random number I pulled up. That's really what most producers, cow-calf or, you know, cattle producers are feeding almost anywhere in the country that you go, actually. It averages out to about 130 days of feeding hay to the animals. And... now, why is that?
Yeah, why should I give a shit? You got 10 seconds. Sell me on this.
Well, it's, why should you give a shit, of course, is the expense. But why would it be so similar across such vastly different climate types and everything that we have in the country has to do with, at least as suggested by Jim Garish, who is actually author of a really great book for going through this process called Kick the Hay Habit.
Oh, look at that. There's an actual book on this.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that. Jim Garish, Kick the Hay Habit. Okay.
A Practical Guide to Year-Round Grazing.
Garish is G-E-R-R-I-S-H. Do you know if it's on Amazon?
I think it probably is on Amazon, but I'm not positive. I know you can get it for sure through Stockman Grass Farmer, which is another publication.
Which is available on Amazon.
Top-notch.
The Stockman Grass Farmer Journal.
Okay, and also you could buy it right from Jim at American Grazing Lands Incorporated, which is, I think, just at americangrazinglands.com. But
we should get a thread going on Permies about this and make sure we get links to all this stuff.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah. So, well, anyway, the point I was trying to get at is money, just money, just clear. Let's just make it clear in case anybody missed it. Money. I mean, you think about it, it's like you go and you raise cattle. And it's like one of the hugest expenses out of the whole thing is keeping them alive during the winter. So there's a lot of people where their whole business is you buy a bunch of cattle in the spring, you run them on a bunch of ground during the summer, and then you sell them in the fall.
Stockage.
I mean, yeah. That's a whole business model, and
sure.
I don't know, I want to say millions of people do it, but it's probably more like tens of thousands of, you know, guys do it. They're all wearing cowboy hats and boots, and they, you know, sometimes they have horses. I don't think many of them have horses anymore. Anyway, the key is that's a whole business model, but for your people that are keen on the organic, that are people that are more of your permaculture people that are more of the helm setters, probably not going to do that. You're going to be probably breeding a little bit and keeping them around all winter. And it does turn out to be that if you keep them in the winter, that's like that's like the most expensive way to fly on this. And it's so then some people are going to go out and they're going to have a tractor and a baler, you know, so you're going to actually, you're going to cut your hay and it's going to dry and then, you know, make hay while the sun shines. So if it rains, you could, your hay could be toast, and now it's mulch. and then you got to bale it. First of all, you got to rake it. So, I mean, I've made a lot of hay. so you're going to cut it, and then some people crimp it. So they've got like a thing that cuts and crimps, and so it helps to dry out faster. And then you're going to leave it out to dry a little bit. Then you're going to come by with a rake that is going to flip it over so the other side will dry. And then you're going to and then sometimes you get the rake to kind of put it into like little tidy rows. And then you come by with your baler and bale it. Then you got to come and pick up all those bales. Bucking bales. I've bucked a few in my day. And you're going to put them all into big stacks. As a kid, I kept thinking, you know, next time it's 30 below outside, I'm going to go stand on top of the haystack and pee off of it to see if, like, little balls of pee appear on the ground. But I've never had the opportunity to do that. I always somehow, like, it's 30 below outside, I don't feel like going outside.
Well, that's true. It's hard to compete with that. I guess if you weren't putting up hay and you weren't using hay in your operation, you would never have that opportunity.
You get to, like, build a platform and then wait for it to get cold enough. Or you can find something just tall enough to stand on that's not a haystack.
That's true.
Maybe build some tree climbing skills.
That's right, but you'd never be able to do it off a stack of hay.
Because you just don't have any hay.
Exactly.
That's right, you would eliminate it all. But the thing is all that stuff are a variety of expenses. The balers, so like where I'm at now, I watched the farmer, John Trask was over here the other day, and then as it got dark, the farmer fired up his swather. And so he's out there using a swather.
Uh-huh.
I used a tractor with a sickle bar, although I have used those things that are kind of like the kind of swather that you pull behind a tractor. But he's got that kind of swather where it's all one piece. It's a motorized swather, and you drive the swather itself.
Right.
And so then he was out here running it at like 11 o'clock at night, you know, or 10 o'clock at night. It was dark. And then he pointed out, Joel Salatin says, I never put lights on a tractor. Never. And I said, well, you know what probably happened is that he's got this, all of his equipment is really old and he's constantly fixing it. So it probably got to the point where it's like, it's time to go out and run the swather. And then he got about 10 feet and then the swather broke down. And then he spent the next 5 days fixing it. And then he finally fixed it at 10 o'clock at night. And so then he's out there making sure it works. And then you know what? It's going to rain in a week. You got to get that hay done. And so it's like, you know, so there's lots of schools. I go buy a new baler or swather. I could buy a brand new swather for way too much money and it won't break down as much. Or I could take this old piece of shit and keep fixing it all the damn time. And, you know, do you call that an expense? Is your time worth anything?
Of course.
So all this hay stuff, all the hay stuff, just the cost of the hay shed to keep it dry, or just the sacrifice of land in order to be able to stack your hay. I mean, these are all expenses. And
absolutely.
So it's like this whole headache, all these expenses, there is this potential of eliminating it. Maybe a good strategy. Now, we're going to talk about a little later on about how you are going to take, you're going to start off where now you're currently feeding your cattle hay and how to transition away from that. And it's not an instant thing. It's going to take years, right? Years?
1 to 3 years, but yeah, probably closer to three. It depends on how much you're feeding to begin with.
Might be a good idea to keep some hay for these years just to be sure. And even when you are in a hayless thing, maybe you want to be in a space where it's kind of like, just to be safe, I always keep a little bit of hay around, maybe.
Well, sure. But, and it depends on what part of the country you're in as well. I mean, a lot of people think, well, I'm just where it snows and we have to feed hay, and don't realize how, you know, the ability of cows to eat through snow, especially when they're not fed hay. And they get used to that and they love it. But there are, you know, pockets here and there of places where maybe your particular conditions do mean that for short windows in the season that it's good to have something on hand, you know, for that possibility. But by and large, most areas everywhere can get away from that.
Okay. So I think I emphasized the money savings thing.
Sure.
So
Sure. And aside from all those, just the costs and all that equipment that you're talking about, part of that is the depreciation every year. So whether you've got brand new or old equipment, whether you're doing a lot of maintenance or a little maintenance, it's still depreciating every year, which is cost you have to account for.
And there's a lot of people who are raising cattle that are basically ending up not making any money at all. When they sell the cattle and then we figure in their expenses, some of them are even running in the red.
Absolutely.
But it's like you've got to, I mean, basically what it boils down to is you've got to be, when you're really successful at raising cattle, then even with a lot of the paddock shift techniques, it's like you've got to watch the margins and keep your expenses down and really, really play the games that are in place in order to be able to do it. Unless, of course, you're doing something where you're doing some direct market stuff or whatever. But if you're going to go and sell them at the stockyard, you're going to sell these animals to the stockyard and buy them from the stockyard and play that game, it is a tough game to play. And there's probably about as many losers as there are winners. Is that about right?
A lot of times more losers than winners. I spoke with, I think it was in 2010, just a guy who happened to be an accountant in Texas. And he was pretty much exclusively an accountant for ranching operations. And he told me that officially in the state of Texas, I believe in 2010, that 3% of ranchers turned a profit.
Oh, shit. Oh, wow, that's way worse than I thought. Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, it's going to vary, of course. But one of the, you know, some people say one of the best ways to focus on marketing is just to reduce your costs so much that it doesn't matter what the market pays for the animals because you're still making money.
Okay. Well, so... Now, I think not only are there going to be people that just want to be able to make more money raising cattle, and I mean, we could talk about a variety of other things about, like, getting more per pound because you're doing a direct market thing or something like that, but we're going to leave that for other podcasts. Today, we're going to talk about how to just simply eliminate the hay, and you kind of started to touch, and we talked about, now, I think the why is the biggest thing, the biggest motivator, because this is, I would imagine that for a lot of, if you were to raise cattle from calf to, you know, as a steer to sell in 18 to 24 months, that probably 60% of your cost, if not more, is going to be in hay.
That does pretty much, it's pretty close to 60%, I believe 50% of your profitability, let's say, would be tied up in winter feed, or, you know, the difference between producers, in other words, in their profitability, 50% of that, 57%, can be accounted for by winter feed, as opposed to something like weaning weights, which is something a lot of producers are sort of chasing after, because kind of traditionally that the thought has been, well, if we have higher weaning weights, and so these are heavier calves that are being sold, well, then we're producing more pounds of beef in through less animals, so it's less efficient. But it turns out that it's also less profitable, and it's not really a profitable way to think about it. Like, by those same statistics where we came up with 57% of the difference in profitability being accounted for by winter feed costs, less than 5% of profitability difference across producers is due at all to weaning weights, even though it gets such a high, that's one of the main goals of a lot of folks down at the coffee shop and whatever, is to brag about the weaning weights. But that really has almost nothing comparatively to do with profitability.
Okay, something popped in my head while you were saying that. I just kind of want to cover this just real quick, and that is that it's not necessarily just cattle. It can also be goats and hogs, chickens to a small extent. I mean, you know, and we got a whole different system for chickens and hogs and stuff like that. But when it comes to hay and, like, eliminating hay, I think goats and cattle are the big ones. What else? Well, I think I'm thinking about, you know, people, alpacas and horses and stuff like that. I mean, we're going to, you know, finish talking about cattle, but there's other animals that can benefit from this too.
Well, absolutely. I mean, with the holistic plan grazing, you know, it doesn't matter what class or stock that you're using. grazing or what the type of livestock, you can definitely plan the grazing out and focus on your forage resource and providing as much of that and improving that as much as possible, all of which goes towards eliminating hay.
I'm guessing you never read my article about paddock shift for chickens.
True.
All right. So Sepp Holzer does it. But anyway, I advocate for raising chickens to use a paddock shift system. I think it'll be simpler.
Absolutely.
Back to cattle. All right. Here's the big question. Here's the thing. You know, I've been kind of pushing this back, building everybody's appetite. They're just dying to know. They're just going crazy. Okay, how the hell do you do this? Ready, go.
Well, there's different places you can start, of course, but I think the main shift you need to make is your attitude. You know, that's what's going to drive everything else. If you don't have the right attitude about it, that, hey, this is just something I'm going to do or something I'm going to move towards, well, then it's not going to happen. So the attitude, I think, is so important in the equation. It underlies everything. And, you know,
do I have to do yoga or something?
No yoga. It's just it's the attitude that you often run into is like, well, it won't work where I am, or that can't work, or it's sort of like the Henry Ford thing. You know, if you think you can or you think you can't, you know, people who think they can are both right. So it comes back to attitude to begin with.
So it's kind of like rocket mass heaters, where you go out and you tell people about it. And then even though you've got this long, rich experience of, like, thousands of people who have done it and said that it worked awesome, that they heated their home with 80% or 90% less wood, they're like, no, they didn't. They're sure it didn't happen. They're absolutely sure it is not possible. So what you're saying is that in this no hay thing, that when you go out and you tell people about, and we've got people that are doing this, and they're not feeding their animals any hay, and they're doing even better over the winter, then the reactions from most people are like, you're lying. You're a liar. That didn't happen. That's not happening. That's impossible. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's a common reaction. They might not call me a liar, but they say, well, it might have worked over there, but it's not going to work at my place because of, you know, X, Y, and Z. And that's the thing, is it definitely won't work if you don't think it's worth trying. If you don't think you can try it.
Lush land at Joel Salatin's place because he's in the Shenandoah where the topsoil is 6 feet deep and they get 80 inches of rain a year, divided evenly over every month of the year or whatever. They'll make up a scenario where it's like they got lush grass in January. And that's why it works over there. But it doesn't work here in Montana.
Right.
But now...
That's the thought.
That's their thought.
That's the mistake.
Tell me you've seen it work in Montana.
Absolutely. Absolutely works in Montana. There's a particular ranch near Dillon that I've come across that I believe over the last, I don't know if I remember these precisely, but something over the last 14 years, they've fed hay 90 days total. Something
awesome.
something like in that range. It can definitely work here and really anywhere in the country, up into Canada. And it doesn't really matter where you are. At the very least, you can reduce this down to a very, very small amount of hay feeding. And if you're talking about saving $100 a cow or something like that, that's a significant bottom line impact. If you're not feeding, like I said, on average, folks are feeding 130 days a year, mainly because they're producing that much hay, because obviously the climate conditions are different over the whole U.S., but if everyone's feeding 130 days, there has to be some other common denominator.
All right, so important things are, A, it's being done in Montana, and if it's being done in Montana, I think that pretty much opens it up to most every other state, and you're saying it's being done in Canada, so even north, so like Alberta, perhaps, which is just north of Montana, so there's that, and then you're saying that, you know, there's this natural resistance to the idea at all, like people just are like, they're not willing to listen, to learn about it, because they're so sure from the beginning that can it be done? Now, if people have made it this far in the podcast, I think they're on board with being open to the possibility.
Absolutely.
Because they probably would have otherwise just turned the whole damn thing off by now.
Sure.
Now, let's assume that these are my peeps. These are my listeners. I think they're open to stuff. So
that if that equation is sort of you're making more feed, you're feeding more feed, then, you know, a natural way to stop feeding as much feed is to stop making as much feed. So, I mean, that can be a great place to start for people who want to get started with this is if you're making hay, maybe think about selling that equipment.
Ka-ching.
You take that money, which you can then use for infrastructure development like fences or, you know, water systems that will enable you to have better control over the animals over the whole year, which will enable a better use of your forage resource and an improvement of the forest resource in the longer term, which will mean you'll grow more feed, much of which you can stockpile for the winter and feed it out on the ground, making the cows work for you rather than you work each morning for the cows putting out hay during the winter. You know, it takes the same or less amount of time to move a fence as it would take you out there feeding the hay, but of course the costs are much different.
Right. So, all right. So I haven't stored. So let's say I'm doing this. So what is it? How is it that these animals? I guess this is the question that I have at the moment. This is the thing I want to convey. I'm not putting out hay, and it's winter, and there's 6 inches of snow on the ground. And I'm not going to give them hay. What are they going to do for food?
Well, as long as you haven't given them hay, they're going to find the food. They know where the food's at, and they'll find it and they'll eat it. And basically, as soon as you start feeding them hay, though, they will not continue that behavior. They will be like, "Well, where's my hay? It came yesterday. That's got to be coming today."
So there's a bit of training the animals, sort of, kind of, a little bit.
That's right. That's right. It takes them a little time to get used to. It's part of the reason you don't want to just launch from 130 days to feeding to zero. And so even if you stop making hay and you sell your equipment, maybe that you're still purchasing some hay that first year, which can be good because it's still adding nutrient from off-site, you know, bringing it to your site, and it helps you sort of adapt. It leaves you the flexibility to use that when it's needed. But over time, the animals will learn how to eat through snow. I mean, there's actually from Alberta, I think, there's tales of cows eating through 4 feet of snow, you know, but and everything below that, of course. Now, when it gets to the point where they've got, you know, bloody noses and look pretty beat up and stuff, you might want to, you know,
show mercy,
back off a little bit. But there's nothing wrong with pushing out to the limit of what they're capable of. And you know, they're there to work for you, to work for their, earn their keep on the farm and on the ranch. And, you know, hopefully it becomes over time this way more of a ranch than a farm instead of vice versa. You're not farming so much hay. I think it's Greg Simons who's a great land manager and ranch manager who says that's the problem with ranching is farming.
Oh, people want to fiddle with it so much. It's like I gotta fiddle and put up my hay. Yeah, okay,
exactly.
All right. As opposed to the more lazier approach, is like, well, if I just skip it, then the cattle will be fine. They'll take care of themselves.
That's right. Instead of you working for the cows, they're working for you.
All right. So here, let me dig into this a little bit more, and that is that I've got two experiences with grasses here in this spot of Montana as an example. So November rolls around. We had some snow. The snow melted off. I can now look up on the hillsides, and, you know, there's different hillsides. Some of the hillsides are covered with trees, and some of the hillsides are covered with grass, or at least grassish stuff. And when I look on the hillsides that have the grass, it's all brown. And so then I'm kind of thinking, like, okay, you know, my knowledge from the past is that the difference between hay and straw is that hay is food and straw is bedding. I mean, it's the same. It can be the same plant. I mean, you can go out and you have a bunch of grass, and if you harvest it If you cut it while it's green and dry it out, now it's food for the wintertime. But if you wait until it's all dried up and yellow, and then you bale it, that's straw, and the animals won't eat that. And in fact, if they do try to eat it, then it's kind of like indicative of, like, you are taking poor care of your animals. They're eating the awful, terrible stuff. So, and then at the same time, I do know that, like, all this last winter, I don't know what I did to my lawn, but all this last winter, it never turned brown. It stayed green all winter long. And I was kind of thinking, like, and I think I've noticed this phenomenon in a couple of different places I've lived. But I'm kind of thinking, like, because where I'm living right now is, like, we're required to keep a lawn, and I kind of don't put a lot of thought into it. But, wow, I've got green grass all winter, which was kind of weird. So I would imagine in most pastures it's going to be kind of brown, kind of dried up and brown. It's the dead stemmy stuff that's left over from the end of the season, and that's what they have to eat.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it depends on, of course, your whole forage resource base that you have on your land. And I think you correctly identified something that you do want to, one of the things you want to focus on, and that is done very well through the holistic plan grazing, is focusing on having more plants growing longer, growing more often at higher densities of plants. So you might not just get to higher densities of animals, but ideally you're going for higher densities of plants. You've got more solar panel out there for longer periods of time, collecting more of that solar energy, turning it into green plant material, which some of which you will stockpile for winter, which will cure to yellow or brown material by the time you're into deep winter, but can also stay green longer, start growing earlier in the growing season and stop growing later in the growing season. But that's definitely one of the things you will focus on as you're making this transition, is sort of identifying your forage resources and what are their growth patterns throughout the year. So you can identify, well, you know, during this growing season I'm getting, you know, this section of, you know, these families of plants that are coming in for a while, and then they have they peak out, and then they start to diminish somewhat. But then maybe your warm season plants, and then in the late fall or whatever, you get your cool season stuff starts coming up. But so you identify what plants you have growing when they peak, when they diminish, where are the gaps in feed, and so you work out strategies then to identify those gaps. Maybe you want to put in winter annuals or summer annuals, or to cover some of these gaps, or you look at the various possibilities that you might have by an understanding of your total feed resource throughout the whole year. So not only the growing season, but also the non-growing season or the winter. So once you have that in line, you can then start to match your animals to the forage resource that you actually have. And when you do that, you should pay particular attention to what the winter feed resource ends up being, and probably stock your ranch the capacity to that winter feed as the basis of it. Now, that doesn't mean you couldn't bring in stockers over the summer, and it might be a good strategy, because you've got a lot more forage coming, say, in the summer, but you're stocked for a winter scenario. Well, maybe that's a great way to deal with that, is bring those in. Bring in the stockers over the summer, and it gives you more flexibility that way in your planning and in your operations, and a separate sort of class of income stream as well. And then once the winter starts to get closer, you get the stockers off and you go back down to what you're stocked for over winter, which is a safe number to deal with that. And you're certainly not going to have to carry near as much hay in that scenario.
So I think part of what you're saying is it's like, it's not like here is this, you go out and you buy a widget and you stick the widget in the ground and then boom, you're all set. It's not like that at all. That instead it's like, here are a dozen techniques that we've figured out so far each one is going to help about 10%. Some of them might help 15%, some of them might help 5%, but you know, some are better than others. But what you want to do is that if you do only two or three of them, you can reduce your hay costs dramatically. And if you do all of them, there are a lot of people that have eliminated their hay costs completely. And there might even still be more things that we haven't quite figured out yet. So it's not just a one thing. It's like, I'm going to do this list of things, and some things are going to make it so that my edibles in the fall go later into the fall. Rather than everything turning brown in September, some things are going to stay green until November. And then in the spring, whereas we first started seeing things turn green in April or May, we're going to start doing things in such a way, we're going to start seeing some things starting to green in February or March. So then, you know, so that's one approach. And then we're going to even find other things that might be dry, but they're edible and nutritious and delicious in January. And we're going to plant more of those. And so it gets to be very multifaceted. And that's my impression.
No, that's absolutely correct. There's multiple strategies that all sort of add up to achieving this. And you're right. You can do just one or two of them at first and start to ease your way into it. But sort of the more of them that you add into the equation, the more they're able to work together as well and give you, you know, so it might not be 1 + 1 = 2 anymore. It might be, you know, 1 + 1 + 1 = 7, you know, or so on, if you get my drift. So there's synergistic effects by, you know, because these things all mutually support each other, these strategies, and can add up to greatly reducing or eliminating hay, and of course, there's the benefits in your bottom line of that. Absolutely.
All right. Are we going to go through a list of things like this, or is that like for another podcast?
Well, I mean, we've sort of been doing it. We've talked about basically doing planning the grazing much more, and based on the forage resource and stocking the animals to the winter capacity more or less, and all of those things work together. And the planning really has to begin before spring green up kind of thing for the year. But that also involves, you know, the way to maximize that, of course, is by probably moving the animals more frequently than is already happening. Maybe you're already moving them every day, but it might mean moving them every day. So you might have to plan some new infrastructure, fencing or water resources to do that. Another big area that can have great returns in reducing the hay feeding is when are the calves coming on your place? When's the calving season of your operation? And is it time to the optimum time of year where the forage is at its highest energy peak? Because the animal nutritional requirements at from calving to through that early when the cows need to be lactating and feeding the calves, that's the highest nutritional demand of the cows during the year, or any animals is at that period of time. But traditionally, or you know, the past century or so, operators have not been calving during that time of year, partly going back to the weaning weight thing. That's some of the justification for calving, say, in winter. It turns out that the time of year when, say, the elk or the deer or the, you know, other large herbivores in your ecology locally, when they're calving, might be closer to the date when it would make sense if you're trying to get out of feeding hay all winter, for you to be doing the calving season also. So that can require an operational shift over time.
So now, if there were no fences and we just left cattle on their own, my impression is that the all these animals get a little amorous around late summer, early fall, and then they start having calves in the like mid-spring. Is that about right?
Well, I mean, yeah, it varies somewhat to where you are and elevations and this and that. But, yeah, I mean, in general.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And elevations and right. Yeah. And it seems like nearly all animals have their babies, at least on the farm, but even in the wild, it seems like it's in the spring. And you know, for a lot of the permaculture systems we talk about, it's all like, okay, you know, I find that when I align my practices more with the natural process, my life becomes way easier. And so, and I like being lazy. I'm big on lazy, and so it kind of seems like now I'm even getting so lazy to the point that I'm not even going to have to go and haul hay out to my animals twice a day through the winter, which, you know, okay, I like this idea so far, but so step one, the calving. Work with the natural cycle instead of working against the natural cycle.
That's right. So, I mean, nature's producing a bountiful amount of energy at that time of year. And, you know, this is, of course, why all the wild animals are calving at that time, because they know they're most likely to be able to meet their nutritional demands at that time, which are, like I say, their highest between calving and rebreeding. So that's when they're getting amorous, like you're talking about. You know, at that time, the better nutrition they can have, then the better off the whole life of that calf is going to have, because it's getting much better nutrition, and then the better off the life of the rebred, you know, the newly bred calf, or the result of the amorous activities is going to have, just because, you know, the higher the nutrition of its parents at that time, the better off it's going to be, and so on. So that's the time that you want, really, you know, high condition scores with your animals and better chances of them breeding back and you know, producing another calf for you. And so doing the work that's sort of carrying their weight in your operation.
Okay, I want to move back to the hay versus straw thing for just a moment. And that is, it seems like it was about 5 or 6 years ago, I read in the Stockman Grass Farmer Journal an article that said, we've been thinking about hay all wrong. And I think that information ties in directly to the going without hay in the winter thing. And that is that the way we've been thinking about our feed is like, oh, we want to, so for years, I remember when raising cattle, the idea was, is we want to improve the protein count. We want to raise grasses that have a high protein count. We want to, you know, mix in some legumes. We have concerns about bloat, of course, but, you know, what can we do to help improve our soils in such a way that we improve the protein count? It's all protein count. And it's like, then this article came out and said, no, you don't think about protein count. Protein count is something you think about if you're talking about raising carnivores or omnivores, but these are herbivores. And what they eat is carbohydrate, which they then convert to protein. And so when we're feeding these animals, we need to be thinking about, you know, how many calories are in it for them, not how much protein there is. It's like they really need to get their carbohydrate. So now, I haven't read very many articles on this topic since then, but I did think that was probably an exceptionally good point, thus trumping the previous 80 articles that I've read on protein count.
Well, I mean, protein is an important component of nutrition, but you can't live on protein alone as one of these animals, or it's no fun. So obviously there's a certain amount of digestible sort of dry matter that needs to be, because the protein stuff tends to be the wetter, greener, you know, types of forage or the nitrogen fixers in the pasture and that kind of a thing are higher in those components. But they need to be balanced out with the drier, more fibrous sort of ration for the nutrition to be really useful, most useful for the animal. So the other aspect of that is that as these plants are growing, which fits in with ultimately with if you're trying to stockpile winter feed, it links into that. So at those times of years when you want that peak nutrition, like we're talking about, The growing tips of the plants are higher in hydrogen and energy, and the lower parts of the plant are higher in protein, just as a ratio. If you keep those animals grazing just the top, so you're grazing pretty tall in that pasture, you're not taking it that pasture down to the bottom, you're going to accomplish several things. And it, you know, the body condition of those animals is going to be better because they're going to be, you know, getting better energy in their ration. The plants are going to recover much faster because you're not taking off as much leaf area at the time. Therefore, there's far more solar panel left behind to and also energy in the root reserves to regrow that plant much more quickly. It'll recover much faster, so you can bring the animals back to that area sooner as a result, and then graze it tall again. But the other benefit of grazing tall, especially later in the growing season, is that you're leaving enough behind to leave that winter stockpile that you're going to then, you know, strip graze through over the winter instead of feeding hay. And so not only does that translate to better nutrition during the growing season, but also better nutrition during the winter for those animals. They will stay in better condition, even though their nutritional demands, of course, are much lower in the winter. They're still important. And if you're feeding hay, their nutritional performance will not be as good as if you're grazing them through these winter stockpile pastures. And part of the reason for that, again, is even there, you're maintaining a much more even level of nutrition through the winter by grazing stockpile pastures than you would be by just feeding out hay.
Okay. All right. And my computer had something to say, too. So better nutrition, then. What else you got there?
Well, I just think, I mean, we'll probably have covered some of the major things. I mean, it gives you more flexibility because you can sort of adjust your stocking rates to that winter forage, and you can bring in other types of animals like stockers during the growing season. So you've got various options. You know what your forage is, where the gaps are, and you're working on strategies to address it. You're planning your grazing throughout the entire year and adjusting as that comes along. Hopefully you're shifting your calving season so that that allows you to reduce that hay input as well. And you're not doing what Jim Garrish calls, you know, taking low-cost forage and turning it into high-cost feed, which is essentially that's mechanical harvesting. That's, you know, that's basically making the hay yourself. It's a good way to do that. Take the low-cost forage that you could have and have the cows out there working for you all winter, eating it and turning it into this high-cost feed that you're then working for them all winter, you know, feeding it out. And this shift can happen, you know, like I say, over 3 years is probably the longest you would even want to go. And, you know, maybe shifting a month at a time each year. And you could shift the calving season that way as well, shift the amount of hay fed that way as well. And, you know, I guess one of the most important places to start, though, is just knowing what is hay costing you right now. Most producers, we're finding, you know, aren't necessarily aware of that number. What am I actually paying each year in right. hay costs? And so sometimes just knowing that number can be a big motivator.
Right, because they've got all that equipment and they're doing all the haying every year and they don't even bother to look it up and they don't sell any hay. So then if they were to assume for a moment that they sold all of their equipment, they didn't have any equipment and they had to buy hay, suddenly they might find out, damn, that's kind of expensive. It's a lot of money. And so, you know, they might start getting some ideas of how much money it's costing them without really thinking about it, that, you know, to build a hay. I mean, how much are they paying in diesel? How much are they paying for that guy, you know, to go out there and do that? Or are they doing it themselves, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, they just don't do the math and add it all up.
That's right.
I want to talk a little bit about what kinds of species do well in the wintertime. And now, on these podcasts, we've talked in the past about chickens and hogs and being able to raise them. And I mean, now it's a no-brainer. I think anybody who's listened to all these podcasts is like, you know, yeah, oh yeah, it's easy to raise chickens and hogs without any feed in the winter. You know, you just got to plant the right things and you do some paddock shift stuff and stuff like that. And then there's a few plants that are like our big go-to plants to pull this off with chickens and hogs. And now I'm kind of curious how many of these probably, you know, cross over into cattle. And I'm not, I don't think that, it's like one of them is sunchokes. We plant a lot of sunchokes and then the hogs will root them up and eat them all winter long. And then the chickens will scratch them and peck at them. But I would think that cattle are not going to be able to do sunchokes.
I don't have any experience with cattle and sunchokes, so I wouldn't be able to speak
right.
to that.
But what I'm sure, what I know cattle do is that we also, you know, suggest planting lots of winter keeper apples, because a lot of those winter keeper apples, the apples will still be on the tree and dropping off a little bit here and there through February. I mean, you know, so they're done growing, you know, sometime around October, November, but they're still like stuck on the tree. And you'll have a big, big tree, you know, and then these apples just keep plopping down as there's a storm or as there's a wind or whatever, you know, and then there's apples on the ground. I know that the chickens and the pigs will get to it, and I know that cattle enjoy apples too. So that would be a feed, one.
Sure. And then,
enough to sustain cattle, really, but it's one of those things, one out of many things that would contribute.
One out of many. And there's probably a lot of tree crops, depending on where you are, that if, as you are looking at that year-round forage base that we talked about, is like seeing where you've, what forages are coming when and where the gaps are and what you need to fill, that can be one strategy to help fill some of those gaps and make sure that you've got feed year-round for those animals. Is some tree crops like you're mentioning, like apples, like honey locusts, like mesquite in some parts, like tagasasti and, you know, very, you know, winter fat, or which are not trees, but, you know, in any case, other plants.
The mango beets. I've heard of some people raising mango beets with the idea of it being cattle winter feed. And I've heard of some people saying, no, the cattle will pull them up and eat them themselves. Mm. And I've heard other people saying, oh, you got to go pull them up for the cattle, and you got to kind of, like, they have a special little cutter that they make where they put the mangoes into a big bucket or barrel, and then they kind of mash them with this cutter, and then it's kind of, like, broken up enough that the cattle can, like, work it from there. But, and then I think kales, a lot of people plant kale for cattle.
Yes, there's different brassicas work for that. People plant turnips or sorghums, or, you know, various, you know, they'll pick a plot to do that on where it will make sense in their overall rotation and strategy, and maybe that's filling one of those gaps. But so all of those will have different trade-offs and drawbacks, but they're worth thinking about in the context of that year-round strategy.
So here in Montana, what would be something where we could say it right now, and then those people that might be a little thinking like, no, it can't be done, what would be something to plant? You don't know. I'm kind of thinking, like, for the existing grasses and stuff, that there is some nutritional value for what's already there, but it was like exactly what you were saying earlier. You know, you didn't graze it down to the ground. You left it standing fairly tall. And now the cattle come and they experience that in January. So for a moment, we'll talk about January. Mm-hmm. And it's like there's a couple of things going on. One is that tall stuff, they will nibble at that and they will eat it, and it does go through their system. And in fact, I think maybe it's not a bad time to point out, and you can tell me if you believe I'm wrong or my, you know, what I'm about to say is stupid. But I always think of cattle as like the only thing that they ever really consume is beer. They are a beer factory. They are a biological beer factory, and then so then they spend some of their time collecting materials to make beer, and then after the beer is made, they spend their time consuming the beer, and then a lot of what comes out is the stuff that it's like when you actually make beer, you get, you know, so many quarts of beer, and then there's this all the spent stuff that you could call not beer. that's like the spent grains and stuff. And so in a lot of ways, cattle are the same way. Well, they make grass beer. You know, they kind of bring in all of this pasture, and then they make beer. They consume the beer, and then what comes out the other side is like the not beer. That's the stuff that didn't quite get made into beer. So then some days, you know, they're going to make grass beer, and some days they're going to make dandelion beer. Some days they're going to make apple beer, and some days they're going to make, I mean, depending on whatever they're running through, they're making beer out of it, and that's kind of what they're into eating. That's why they all kind of stand around, they have that look on their face, like a bunch of guys at the bar that have kind of got a pretty good buzz going on.
I hadn't heard that theory before, but you're right. They're definitely walking vats of fermentation happening, and they're processing a lot of grass material, which they do best on, as opposed to maybe grains that you make beer from. But definitely processing those grasses, and 90% of that, of what goes in, comes out the back end in a different form, but fortunately a usable form if we're using this type of system.
Right, and what comes out the back end turns out to be the perfect winter pig food. I mean, there's a lot of cattlemen, a lot of people raising cattle, and they're not raising any hogs. And it's kind of like a waste.
Well, and that's something else you can do is in this planning, looking at different classes of animals, and there are people running, you know, multiple classes of animals together, of course, livestock, goat, sheep, etc., or cattle, goat, sheep, maybe pigs, you know, maybe chickens as well, but what we're finding is often, sometimes folks are doing this as a single herd as well. Others are doing a leader-follower system, but what that'll tend to do is increase the diversity of the plants that you have in that pasture, which nutritionally is a good thing. It allows the animals to self-medicate. You can end up having less veterinary expense and various things like that as a result, because all of these animals are eating from slightly different niches in the pasture ecology, and therefore sort of stimulating different growth patterns. And so
let's say that you get to November and you've got this field, and the grass in that field is like 18 inches high, and now you put a bunch of cattle in there, and they nibble it down to being 6 inches high, and then they leave. And then they come back to this pasture again in January. And this is, you know, and I mentioned January specifically because I'm thinking this is where people are going to have the hardest time grasping it.
Okay.
So those particular grasses, you know, they can nibble on those some more. But it turns out that by having grasses at 6 inches high or 12 inches high or whatever, that below the grasses, I mean, that kind of acted as kind of sort of not a great windbreak, but a little bit, and combined with the snow and whatnot, that there are other little plants down next to the soil that have managed to stay a little bit greener than if you had just mowed it down to the ground in October. So now there's not only the stemmy stuff that they're going to eat, which is part of what they use to make beer, but also there's some of this other greenery stuff, which they also use to make beer. And now they're going to make a different kind of beer than they made back in October, but they're still getting all their nutrient equivalents that might not have been there if you had hayed this land or if you had grazed it down to stubble or something like that.
Absolutely right. Well, I mean, if you hay it down in October or graze it down in stubble at that point, you're not going to have the winter feed there, obviously, because it's just not going to be the time to regrow and get you where you need to be, which is why you need to pay attention to what your winter reserve is going to be in your planning during the growing season so that you can get through the winter season. Now, it doesn't mean that in some places or others, you may not, during some portions of the winter, need to also add some supplementation into the feed just to, so the animal's getting full nutrition. It might not come exclusively from what you have out there, but it still ends up being a lot less expensive than feeding hay, just to have them eat winter feed off the ground or out of the standing reserve that you've left, and add a little supplementation to, you know, for what might not be in that feed for short periods. So that, you know, that can be part of your overall strategy. And in terms of coming into an 18-inch pasture and grazing it down a certain amount, what we're finding is that, especially if you have many pastures in a row or strips that you're grazing in strips that are, say, they're all at 18 inches, well, there's different ways. You could come in and graze each one all the way down, but what's happening at that time is different portions of that plant, vertically speaking, are using different microbiology to process them in the fermentation vat that is the animal. So you're sort of going through a roller coaster cycle if you're doing it that way. Whereas if you came through those same pastures and just took a few inches at a time, or, you know, say the top 6 inches or whatever, instead of the whole plant before you moved, well, then that plane of nutrition is much more even. Therefore, the microbes in the gut don't have to shift themselves around so much, and you're not on this roller coaster. You can come back and do the next few inches and so on, but the plane of nutrition stays much more even. The animal stays, condition stays better through the winter that way. And also, if you're able to leave then a certain amount of the plant before spring green up, you're going to have spring green up likely happen sooner, just because there's more protection on the ground and so on.
So now, in the world of permaculture, a lot of what we do is introduce a lot of texture to the landscape, which is not very helpful if you're trying to take a tractor to the whole landscape. But what it does do is it makes so there are some pockets. There's a lot of pockets. There's a lot of spots of texture, because when you convert a landscape so that a tractor can go back and forth and plow a whole field or do something to a whole pasture, like you want to mow it. Oh, I'm going to mow the whole pasture. Then you've kind of homogenized the land. But if you make it so that there's so much texture of the land that you can't get a tractor in there, really, then you end up with a lot of microclimates and edge of a variety of different kinds. And so then you end up with places where some plants will grow well and they won't grow well over there, but something else will grow well there, as well as like little pockets where things will grow up through November or December, and then things will also start to blossom or start to grow in February rather than in April or May. And so you can kind of start to gain on these. And so there are things that are growing later into the season. And so then there's that. But what's the thing I was talking about before is I think a lot of farmers or a lot of cattle folk that they're thinking to themselves, like, it's hard for them to believe what's being said here, partly because it's like when November rolls around, all of their pasture land is down to just, you know, 1 inch tall stubble. Everything is done. As far as they're concerned, it's done. And I think that the picture I'm trying to paint is to say, yes, when you do that, I think it's rare to see anything green on that soil. And if you do, it's so tiny that you cannot imagine it feeding a cow. You can't imagine feeding any kind of, you know, animal of any size. And so what I'm trying to do is trying to paint a picture of saying, but if you leave that stuff in some fields 18 inches tall, that the amount of greenery on the ground may be, I'm going to make up some numbers here, 10 or 20 times more, so that when you come around in November, there's 10 or 20 times more greeny bits on the ground that are literally green in November. And that when you pass animals through there, and there's going to be some of that that's going to actually make it through to January. And so you're nodding your head.
Well, I mean, Greg Judy, who's a rancher there and who's doing the holistic plant grazing, he's actually doing some mob grazing and so on. And he's got several properties because he leases a bunch and everything. But he's in Missouri. And that's what he's been finding over time, is sort of just what you're talking about. That as he's increasing the recovery periods for the plants, as he's doing the grazing tall thing, which allows faster recovery, he gets thicker swards in there. The density of those plants increases, the density of the solar panel, so much more energy from actually is being processed through the same amount of ground. And then leaving that piece as tall into the winter for his winter feeding, he's finding that he'll, you know, reach his hands down into that sward and part it in the middle of winter and find, you know, green plants within there.
Which would not have been there if they had gotten it down to like only 1 or 2 inches tall.
No, which was, you know, his former practice before getting into sort of this style of animal management was more to graze things down to the ground and then, you know, feed out the hay all winter on a pretty, you know, no growth type of situation.
So now, see, I think that this point that we just described, so in the world of permaculture, like when I go give a presentation on how to grow your garden without using any irrigation, you know, grow your full garden, then it's like it's one of those things where it's like, okay, there's like 18 different things that we're currently aware of that are techniques that you can use, and all of them combined, or even a few of them combined, will get it done enough. But there's one technique that everybody can easily wrap their heads around, and then it's like with that one thing in their head, it's like, okay, now it's possible. And then the other 17 techniques are things like frosting on the cake. But if they just have this one technique in their head, then it's possible, and then they can go out and do it. And you know what that technique is. No, you don't. Hugelkultur. So I'm thinking of Hugelkultur.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't know the reference there. It was like the context.
So I'm thinking...
meant for grazing? You meant
No. This is like for raising a garden. Now, I think with just that one technique of saying, you're going to leave some stuff standing. And then I think somebody who raises cattle is going to say, what a waste. You didn't do anything. You just left that grass there, 18 inches tall. Are you a fool? And I think what we're, you know, so we're painting a picture here and we're saying, here's what we're doing. And now because we've left that there, 18 inches tall, when we come back to it in November, they eat some and they got some green bits that would not have been there if you didn't leave that there. They got green bits and they got, you know, the stemmy bits, kind of dried up, but they ate some of that too. Then we have them come back again in January, and they got more stemmy bits and more green bits. Now, granted, when we come back in March, a lot of that's probably not made it that long. On the other hand, because of what we've done in March, we've got some things that are actually getting started to green up really early in the season. So this is the picture I'm trying to paint. I think that just by staying this is one thing out of a list of things, but by stating this one thing, I think people can wrap their heads around this one. I just wish there was like a word for it, like Hugelkultur, and then you could like say,
the thing is planning. The word is holistic plan grazing is so that's really how you get to the point where you're leaving those areas because you plan to do it and you figure out a way and a strategy based on your forage resource and your animals and matching those two things together that allows that to happen.
Okay. Winter grass, just leaving the grass for winter. I mean, it would be this one technique that I think I just outlined that, you know, but anyway, all right.
Absolutely.
So on the list, one of the things that you told me about as we were talking about this before we started the podcast was that, you know, not only do the animals, I mean, well, maybe we should touch on this a little bit, but that, and I think you did touch on a little bit already, and that is that the animals themselves, through these techniques, end up getting better nutrition than if you were feeding them hay. Now, you know, granted, for a lot of them, they're going to still be, I mean, there's going to be some of this stuff on the ground still, but most of it's been, you know, eliminated. But, and they're getting hay. And we talked about the part where it's kind of like they don't want to go and you know, push the snow aside to get to the food unless, you know, as long as there's hay available, why bother? But now let's assume that we've moved. So tell me about better, like by doing this technique, you get better nutrition.
Well, we did touch on that. And that was the aspect of, you know, during the winter, if you're going through and just taking sort of an even plane of nutrition instead of the roller coaster sort of approach, so you're just taking it, you know, the top several inches, say, of the plant at a time, so the microbes don't have to do a whole turnover.
Right. I'm thinking more like in the middle of winter.
Yeah, that is the middle of winter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the plants are mostly dried up or whatever, even if you haven't got to the stage where you've got more green in there in the winter. Even if they're just eating cured forage, it's still, because it's standing on the ground and all that, it hasn't been cut and dried and everything, it's a better nutritional quality. And like I said, you might still have to, in some places of the country, supplement, during, you know, depending on what your forage is and its nutritional content, supplement a little bit or what have you. But in the end, you know, the total nutrition of those animals is going to be improved from hay feeding.
Okay. Well, another one is better land health. The first thing that pops into my mind is the idea that when you trim a plant back to being 2 inches tall, that its root system is not going to be as robust as if you leave it at 18 inches tall.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, you know, so over time, you're going to be improving the health of you know, the soils of your pastures, your range, your grasses, your other plants in there, just by doing this type of grazing management. Actually sort of increases all, the effectiveness of all your ecosystem processes, which translates into better land health. You're going to be storing more water in that ground. There's going to be more microbial activity in that ground. There'll be a higher diversity of plants that are producing more forage more of the year, because that's part of the aim, is to increase that forage amount so that you've got more of it to leave for the winter time. And of course, this is a long-term strategy, you know, to improve your forage base there, and that way you're able to ultimately carry more animals there, and that's typically far more than, say, your NRCS or somebody would recommend for the generally that area or that type of landscape, because their recommendations are not based around this type of grazing management or this type of, you know, plant and soil management, which is part of it, grass management. So so definitely the land health is a huge goal of this, and we see it happen really everywhere it's tried.
So now I've gotten through all of my list of things to cover in this podcast. How's your list look?
I think we're looking good. I think we've nailed down the major points here of what it takes to and what's involved in making the transition to reducing and eliminating this hay cost input.
All right. I think that's a wrap then. You got anything else to add?
Well, thanks a lot for the opportunity. It's been fun.
Thanks for doing this with me, Owen. Thanks for sharing, man. All right. If you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about raising cattle, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.